You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. My name is Esther Ann, and I am your host this afternoon. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland. We explore topics such as restorative justice, restorative practices, decolonization, cultural revival, and more. Our guests are people involved in aspects of truth, healing, and change work. This program is offered in an effort to share, inform, and inspire. Dawnland Signals is a collaboration of Maine Wabanaki Reach and WERU-FM. The Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act of 1980 brought to a close a tumultuous decade in which the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy tribes sued the state of Maine for illegal sale and transfer of Aboriginal land. A complex out-of-court settlement was negotiated and was originally framed as a, quote, watershed victory, unquote, for the tribes. But the ink was barely dry when it was discovered that the written document did not accurately reflect the tribe's understanding of the settlement. Today, we will be talking about the original meaning and intent of the Maine Indian land claims, the formative years leading up to the land claims, and how the Settlement Act still creates ripple effects that continue to rock the boat of tribal-state relations. This month, October 2020, marks the 40th anniversary since the Settlement Act was signed into law. How did the land claims case begin? What were the tribes aiming to accomplish? And where did it go wrong? Join us as we begin this critical conversation about an important and complex topic. So, I'm excited this afternoon to have a special guest on our show today, Maria Gerard of Penobscot Nation. Maria is a tribal historian with a master's degree in history from the University of Maine. In 2001, she wrote a master's thesis on the land claims entitled The Original Meaning and Intent of the Maine Indian Land Claims, Penobscot Perspectives. And she has been an ongoing independent scholar of the Maine Indian land claims ever since. And you also know that she is co-host of Dawnland Signals and the executive director of Maine Wabanaki Reach. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be talking about one of my favorite topics today, the Maine Indian land claims. As you mentioned, I did my master's thesis in research around the topic of the land claims. And before I sort of delve in and start talking about some of the things that I have learned over many years, I wanted to first take a minute to just locate myself in this research. I feel like locating oneself in the research sort of challenges these Western research standards of objectivity, you know, so it's more aligned with an indigenous methodology of research. So to begin with, to locate myself in this history, my earliest recollection of the Maine Indian land claims came from home, you know, when I was a child in the 1970s. And I lived on Indian Island with my grandmother. And during that time, my grandmother was intensely interested in the case. She would, you know, record the news every night to, in hopes of catching information about the land claims on the news. You know, she placed this cassette recorder in front of the, on the floor in front of the big TV console, and I remember how excited everyone was when our little community was named on the national news, and so that was a really big deal. But like I said, I was 11 years old, so I never associated what was happening on the evening news, in the newspapers, my grandmother going to meetings, you know, all of this busyness. I didn't associate that with the physical changes that were happening in our community at the same time. And so, you know, as a young person at the time that this land claims was really getting some momentum, we were just young kids in the community, right, Esther? So in my community, I know I was seeing like physical changes as our community expanded. You know, we used to have on Indian Island Down Street and Oak Hill, and that was about it. And then all of a sudden there's new roads and this construction of a community center and the construction of a public safety building and a health department. And there was this new phase of housing in our communities. It was, you know, so fancy in our, you know, the scope that we were used to, that we referred to it as Hollywood.
Hey, we had a Hollywood too.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
And
yeah.
We had an outdoor outdoor swimming pool, which I thought was just something I only saw in the Brady Bunch, you know?
Yeah, so things were really starting to change in our community, and we were able to witness those changes. And I always think it's, you know, rather unique that we are the age that we are, so that we could clearly remember our community before the land claims, and then sort of as things were transpiring and those dynamics within the community, and now having, you know, many decades after the land claims to look at, you know, how it has played out. So, you know, one of the things that struck me as an adult in my community, so I had worked for Penobscot Tribe since 1986, I believe, and there was always a lot going on. You know, I witnessed numerous frustrations and limitations, you know, that had been supplanted on our community or on our inherent sovereignty. And, you know, so I was paying attention to all of these issues that were constantly coming up, and it seemed like all things pointed back to the land claims. And so when I was in college and going through the history program at the University of Maine, and thinking about what it was that I wanted to focus on, I was really interested in the land claims, and always had been, you know, intrigued as all these issues came up. You know, it caught my attention, and I wanted to understand that better because I didn't feel as though it was as black and white as it was being projected in the community. So I also felt that learning more about the historical context of the land claims was really important to understanding the written document. And I really got inspired in my history program when I read a book by Jack Rakoff. And this book had to do with the Constitution. And it was... I wish I had the name of the book right in front of me, but I don't. But it looked at the Constitution, and it looked at the written document, and it talked about how understandings in a written document can change over time, particularly when people forget the historical context in which that document was created. And so... I wanted to go back in my research and look at those things. I wanted to examine the historical context in which the Indian Land Claims Settlement Act was framed. So I looked at the socioeconomic conditions that were happening in the tribe prior to bringing the suit. I looked at the historical relationship between the tribes and the state of Maine, and the enormous pressure that both sides were under to hurry up and come to an agreement. And so this is what inspired me to look deeper into the land claims. And I know our first question was about where did it all begin? And it's hard to really find a point to begin this story because, you know, our communities, our tribes had known for centuries about the loss of the land, the extreme losses that came with the loss of territory. So, you know, when being sort of hemmed in into our little tribal communities. And this was all common knowledge for a very long time. And it was passed down orally from generation to generation about the extreme theft of our territories. And, you know, people carried that with them and really feeling powerless to do anything. You know, all of this history is all, you know, intertwined. And, you know, when we look at the historical context of the land claims, if we think back and realize that the tribes in the state of Maine didn't even have the right to vote. So they had no say in the political process until 1967 in a state election. So the tribes were very, very small and relatively powerless to do anything to change the course of action. So, you know, understanding and realizing the losses and how it affected them and really not being able to do anything about it for a very long time. So I would say that things changed in that regard during the 1960s when, you know, the whole country was, you know, rising up and finding their voices, and marginalized people were finally starting to, you know, step into the center and tell their stories. And so I believe that sort of the radical age of the 60s helped to push this land claims story along, you know, into an actual case. And it actually originated with the Passamaquoddy women. And I give credit to the women in Indian Township for really being the catalyst that that caused this case to take off.
It makes me, I can't help but think of the importance of storytelling and truth telling to any process, right? Especially any restorative process, but how important when you talk about, we've always known because we have, you know, passed these stories down orally, this history down. So we've always known our relationship to the land. And it's so important.
Absolutely.
For those structures for us to, you know, now I think we have to intentionally create those structures for truth telling and storytelling, but it's so important.
Absolutely. And the reason I was excited to have this conversation today is, you know, coming off the back of the latest legislation here in the state of Maine, the LD 2094 bill, that was the tribal state task force that was seeking to make changes. Did I say LD 2094?
You did.
I just want to make sure.
You did.
Okay, I'm just making sure that I'm saying the right piece of legislation. So it was the task force that's seeking to make changes to the Maine Indian Claim Settlement Act. And I followed that with a lot of interest. And it was actually the second task force of its type that I followed very intently. And, you know, and then watched it as it lost progress. And I almost felt, you know, early on in that first meeting of the task force that I could kind of see the writing on the wall because I had participated in the previous task force. And just, you know, personally, I didn't have a whole lot of hope for us being able to accomplish what we were setting out to accomplish. But I feel like everything is a step, you know, in that direction. And when you talk about the importance of storytelling and sharing stories, there's so much behind this land claims history that is not represented. It's not represented at the legislature. And there really isn't time or the structure to have those sorts of deep conversations and to really delve into one's stories.
Yeah.
So
you are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I am your co-host, Esther Ann. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Today, we're talking about the Maine Indian land claims. And Maria was just talking about watching the current process to try to implement changes to the Claim Settlement Act and the Implementing Act.
Yes, I was noting the absence of the stories that I think are critical to the understanding of this land claims, because a lot of times it seems as though people think that history between the tribe and the state began in 1980 when this land claims was settled. But, you know, it goes back so far. It goes, you know, this land claims saga is steeped in all kinds of colonial underpinnings and broken agreements and broken treaties and, you know, being tricked out of, you know, hundreds of acres of land.
I've done some research. I've been going down these rabbit holes reading all of this information about the Claim Settlement Act. I haven't ever really studied it. You know, I've paid attention, obviously, and experienced some things. But I found this quote in a Wabanaki Alliance newspaper, August 1980, by then Governor Wilford Pearson of Penobscot. And he said, "I've lived with the land claims a long time. I'm glad they will finally be over. Our feelings run deep because of the way our people have been kicked around." So, you know, everything that you're saying there.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, realizing the situation and, again, you know, not really knowing what it was that they could do about it, especially when, you know, you're impoverished and sort of living on the fringes and no say in the political process. And so I wanted to, you know, return to looking at some of the early history. And I always like to make a point to acknowledge those women that I mentioned. So, you know, so much of this land claims history, like I said, is focused in legislative actions. It's focused on the actions and activities of the negotiating team and their legal advisors. And, you know, the negotiating teams were primarily, you know, comprised of these key male figures from the tribe. You know, but it was the women of Passamaquoddy who, in my opinion, should be credited with creating this momentum that eventually became the land claims case. And the story begins to take shape in 1964, when four Passamaquoddy women were arrested for protesting what they believed to be an illegal land transaction on a section of Indian Township that's known as the Strip. And so the Strip is a portion of the Passamaquoddy Reservation on U.S. Route 1 in Princeton, Maine. And the circumstances around this land transaction involved a non-native owner of some hunting camps. William Plaisted owned these Plaisted hunting camps. And so as the story goes, he actually won the deed to the land in question during a poker game. And, you know, Placid Camps had was an establishment that had built on the edges of tribal lands and was located on the strip. And, you know, several women of Indian Township asserted that the land that Placid had supposedly acquired in a poker game was clearly Indian land, that it had been used annually by tribal citizens for gathering wood, for harvesting. And so a sit-in ensued protesting this land transactions. And the women who were involved were Phyllis Sabatis, Pauline Stevens, Rita Ranko, and Delia Mitchell. And these four women were arrested for blocking Placid's attempt to alter the land and to, you know, move gravel and to, you know, start making changes to the land that he thought he won fair and square in a poker game. You know, so these women were arrested and and charged with disorderly conduct for refusing to move from a pile of sand at the site of a piece of disputed land at Princeton, is how it was described in the newspaper. And so I always like to give recognition to the role that they played in being the catalyst for all of this.
That's wonderful. Never underestimate the power of, you know, getting together and speaking up, right?
That's right. And so when they were arrested, the chief of the tribe at the time was interested in not only helping them with their legal situation, but he was interested also in exploring the larger land loss that they were confronted with. They had a treaty from 1794 between the Passamaquoddy and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And this treaty documented, you know, in detail, approximately 40,000 acres of land that was to be held in perpetuity for the Passamaquoddy tribe. But at that point in time, in 1964, nearly all that land had been parceled out, sold, and lost by Passamaquoddy people. And so, interestingly enough, with the neighbors, with Passamaquoddy neighbors to the west, the Penobscot, during the same time frame, they were taking some efforts to confront their land loss as well. And they retained an attorney from Massachusetts to look into the treaties and to establish what was due them on these treaties. They asked for a moratorium on any more legislation affecting the tribe. And I have a quote here that I really like and appreciate. It's a statement that was read by the Massachusetts attorney, James Murphy. And he read it to the Legislative Welfare Committee in August in 1957. And it states, quote, "The Penobscot are not wards or citizens of the state of Maine. They are Penobscots, a free people. The state may not legislate unilaterally as to the Penobscot nation, its land, or its existence." And then further in his statement, he said that the Penobscots intended, quote, "to take all peaceful measures necessary to preserve their nation as a free nation and their people as a free people." And that's the end of the quote. And then in the news article where this is laid out, my great uncle, Nicholas Ranko, he was a Penobscot elder at the time, and he was considered the last war chief of the tribe. And his quote in that same article says, You have laws of your own. Break them or amend them if you want to, but leave our laws alone. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, both tribes were taking a stance. And then, you know, when the incident happened in an Indian township on the Strip, that became an opportunity for the tribes to confront their issues of land loss a little bit more deeply.
It seems to me that in those, that quote that you read from your uncle and the action that the women took, that they completely did understand sovereignty, right? I know we talk about that word so much, and it's, we have conversations about it, and it's really a difficult topic, thing to, it's complex, but it seems like in that quote of your uncle, he understood it pretty clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it gets complex because, you know, the term sovereignty really is not a term that's in our language, but we understand the meaning of having the right to govern our own affairs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the colonizers and the settlers and all the people started arriving on our shores, we already had a system of governance that was working quite well for us. And we were doing well, and we were healthy, and we, you know, had close kinship groups. And the arrival of people with completely different mindsets to our homelands was, you know, I can't even imagine what that must have been like for our ancestors to endure. But they understood, you know, the inherent rights. And, you know, there's a great quote, a good source of information regarding the early history between the tribes and the new state of Maine or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. A great resource is in the historical petitions. And so the tribes would get together and somebody would help them to put together a written petition and deliver that to the government to protest many actions. And you can see that throughout history, many, many petitions protesting the actions that are being taken against them. And there's this one quote that I love, and it's Penobscot petition from 1804, and it says, the God of nature gave us our fisheries, and no man alive has the right to take that from us. Mm. And so they had a strong understanding of their homelands and what was theirs. And, you know, we didn't have the language for it, for what was happening to us, but I'm sure that, you know, well, it's hard to imagine all of the feelings that must have been there.
Yeah, I'm again reminded of a, and I don't know who to credit to, a quote I heard about, now I forgot it, I'm sorry. But I will say, this is a good time to say that you are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I am your co-host, Esther Ann. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Today, we're talking about the Maine Indian land claims. And I remembered what I was going to say. When the Native people hear ours, or we think of connection and instead of ownership or dominion over. So, you know, when we talk about what was theirs, it's the connection and the relationship to it, to that land, because this concept of ownership was foreign to us.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, when we think about the Maine Indian land claims, you know, we've been talking for probably 45 minutes now, and we've just barely touched the iceberg of all the many backstories associated with what became the legal suit. And I think that there's so much information in all these different backstories to have an understanding of what was the conditions like when the tribes were trying, you know, they're trying to come out from underneath the thumb of the state government. I have this wonderful quote that I've used for a while, and it's from Florence Nicola Shea, who was a, you know, an activist in her own right, Penobscot woman. And interestingly enough, I have the quote number written down, and I'm flipping through, and that is not the page. We're having a hard time with quotes today. but if I flip back, I'm going to find it because it's very powerful.
I know I have been, like I said, I've been doing a lot of online research and reading these newspapers and all of these articles about hearings that had happened and quotes from Native people. And one that I appreciate, it was a hearing in which some folks from Indian Island, some Penobscot folks showed up to oppose the bill as it was in that form at that time. And I don't know, this was in the 1980 edition of this newspaper, but it was Eunice Crowley, Penobscot. And she said, "The settlement makes us first class wards of the state of Maine and the U.S. federal government." she said, "I want to go on record as opposed to," it was S-2829, "and that I'm not a sellout for the reasons of expediency and financial gain." So this, you know, this wards of the state and under the thumb was definitely, you know, the felt by Native people at the time. I saw that wards of the state phrase used a lot in a lot of the quotes from Native people.
Right. And so it became very clear when you look back over the course of history that one of the purposes of this land claims case was to free themselves from the treatment that they had been receiving under the state of Maine government. And so over a period of years, the state government had made laws that negatively affected the tribe. They were really involved in all aspects of tribal existence. And that wasn't, you know, the way that it was supposed to be. You know, when we negotiated treaties, at the time we were negotiating treaties, we were considered a sovereign nation, because treaties can only be negotiated between sovereigns. Mm-hmm. And so at the point when we were negotiating treaties and coming up with agreements on how to exist in this space together, we were at least acknowledged as a sovereign nation. And then over the period of years, as you know, as our communities broke down as a result of, you know, having a different set of government rules supplanted on them, or having outside government interference into the ways of their own system of governance. You know, it was a continual erosion of our sovereignty and our inherent right to govern our own affairs. And one of the more contentious periods of time in history, even within our own communities, at Penobscot, it was called the old party, new party split. And it was where the, you know, state government asserted their way of doing government onto our tribe. And so prior to that assertion, we had our own system of governance, and we had a hereditary chief system, so that, you know, when you were the chief, you served for as long as you could throughout your life. And when you were done, somebody you know, chose another chief from your family line. And so this was the traditional system of governance. And the state wanted an election. They wanted, you know, term limits and all of these things that were foreign to us. And so we get fighting amongst ourselves about what's the way to go. Do we go along to get along? Do we keep doing our own thing, realizing that, you know, we just keep getting chopped at and chipped away at. And so these were the circumstances that the tribes were trying to come out from under. It wasn't just about the land and the theft of the land. It was also about the losses and being able to control their own affairs and to take care of their own people, to have, you know, lands available to hunt and to gather on and to live on. And so there was just, you know, so much to consider in terms of what it was that the tribes are hoping to establish. And then now when you look at the land claims and any discussions that have to do with the land claims in this, you know, quote unquote settlement act, you know, I say that because I know that there's so much that was left unsettled. I just lost my train of thought. What was I talking about?
I think you were going to look for the Florence Nicola Shea quote, but I wanted to let folks know that we are compiling a resource list that we will post on Maine Wabanaki Reach website of places people can go for continued learning and further reading, with the disclaimer that we're not responsible for how many hours you spend because it's hard to stop reading. I'll admit, I hadn't ever really done a lot of this research, but I keep saying I'm going down this rabbit hole. But I'm enjoying it too. It's really nice to see pictures of people, especially those that have passed, and to see their words. So.
Absolutely. So this quote that I was talking about, I did find it by Penobscot, Florence Nicola Shea, and she was an advocate for Indian rights, and she spoke out against the state and its broken treaty promises. And, you know, she was really obviously feeling the full effect of state practices that were destroying Native culture. And Florence says, quote, "The treaties are merely useless pieces of paper today, as all promises have been broken. We are a segregated, alienated people, and many of us are beginning to feel the weight of the heel that is crushing us to nothingness. We are still in slavery, we are dictated to, and we are made to feel that we do not own our own souls." And so this was the environment from which we were trying to rise up out of in negotiating and bringing suit against the state of Maine. And, you know, like I said, all these long history of oppression while living under the thumb of state government, you know, it's amply documented in the government's own legislative petitions and testimonies and special reports. And so it's so important to understand the historical context in which this Settlement Act was negotiated through so much wisdom in our communities. You know, the quotes you share about Eunice and Florence, and again, you know, we're hearing quotes from a lot of very outspoken women, strong women in our communities that have been in the forefront for a very, very long time. You know, this quest for change is not something that happened last year with LD 2094. This is something that has been gradual and continual for a very, very long time. And so everything that we're doing is a step, I believe, in the right direction.
Yeah, and yeah, there was some quotes by folks, tribal people that were really, you know, the fear of losing sovereignty, losing who we are as a people. There's one by at the same hearing where Eunice Crowley spoke, Lorraine Dana, it was Nelson at the time, Penobscot, said, "I feel like the taking of my lands under this bill is a violation of my constitutional human rights. My main concern is not money. My main concern is my sovereign rights. We will not even be an Indian nation." So that, you know, it's almost like, to me, I think of kind of like a choiceless choice that, you know, you have to be within this different worldview and this different system and this different framework of even thinking, and mm-hmm. some and the fear of what that means too. You know, it must have been an impossible time for people.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, as soon as you said the word fear, my ears perked right up, because I say so much of what happens between the tribe and the state is based in fear, and oftentimes in, you know, trying to project forward what certain things would mean down the road. And, you know, like...
And wanting, really wanting things to, you know, be better, and wanting the best for everybody at the same time, and not only thinking about themselves and then, but the future, future mm-hmm. generations, thinking about us now down the road.
Right. And so there's so much. I mean, we just, like I said, we touched the tip of the iceberg. The history is so long. It's so complex. There's so many stories. That I'm really excited to be able to talk about Wabanaki Reach's upcoming project.
Great. So, we got about 20 minutes, so you have plenty of time.
Oh, 20 minutes. Okay. So I'll just touch on it right now, and please feel free to add to it. But, you know, Wabanaki Reach is probably, I always say, the biggest claim to fame so far has been our Truth and Reconciliation Commission that occurred between 2012 and 2015. And of course, we know that there was such a long backstory even to get to that point. And so we have, you know, this ability to be able to hold and to support difficult conversations. And so watching with great interest the LD 2094 proceedings this past year, I was just chomping at the bit to want to try something a little bit differently. Like I said, so much of the history and so much of the conversation is involved with legislation and legalese and attorneys, and I'm really interested in moving the conversation from the head to the heart. And so Wabanaki Reach will be announcing soon details about a second truth-telling project. And as a follow-up to the historic Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we're hoping that this one will be just as historic. And while
with a shorter name.
Be, yes, with a shorter name that people can remember to say. I still stumble on the long name. But, you know, this project is consistent with our track record of being able to engage in these and support these difficult conversations. And it will focus on education around the Maine Indian Land Claims and storytelling. For now, we'll leave out the reconciliation because that's a topic all in and of itself. But I think it's really important to be able to highlight the complexities, like you were talking about. You know, people who were concerned about, you know, selling out, and people who were concerned about our needing to buy back our land, and we, you know, we shouldn't have to do that. And then there were people who were involved that, you know, elders at the time who said, you know, we've lived in poverty for so long mm-hmm. and, you know, just struggling to get by. Let's just hurry up and get this done. And I want to, you know, enjoy the fruits of this, this law case. And, you know, there really was the belief that this was going to be a financial boost in the arm for many people.
Well, the housing, you know, people could move back. There was houses to move back to, and healthcare. I mean, a lot of things changed.
Absolutely.
You know, like you said,
so
you are listening.
Point.
Oh, I just want to do a station break. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I'm your co-host, Esther Ann. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Today, Maria Gerard and I are talking about the Maine Indian land claims. And sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, that's okay. Time flies, huh? When we're having fun.
I know it. Got about 15 minutes to go.
All right. So I can go back and talk a little bit more about this story as it has transpired, the beginning of the land claims history. And I had mentioned the four Passamaquoddy women and how the Passamaquoddy women really were the catalysts for this change that happened. And then when they got arrested, their chief wanted to support them in their legal battle, but he also wanted to look at the treaty and the loss of substantial amounts of land. And as I said prior, we were so impoverished and so powerless and so few in number. And it was such a struggle to find anyone that with any interest in representing the tribe. So after looking for a very long time, he was able to finally secure Don Jellers from Eastport. He was an attorney that lived in Eastport, and Don Jellers agreed that he would take on this land claims case. And what's funny is that, you know, there's this whole side story about how, you know, tribal funds ended up, you know, in the state coffers, you know, and that's a whole nother side story that I don't have time to get into. But Don Jellers had to go to the state government, the executive council, and ask for funds to be released from what they called their Indian fund. And he had to ask for them to release funds to the Passamaquoddy tribe so that they could pay him to sue them. So
they really called
like
it they called it the Indian Fund.
Something like that.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
How ironic. And he had, did they appreciate the irony of that?
Well, about, I think he went down three different trips to Augusta to appeal to them for these funds. And finally, they were like, oh, you know, let the Indians have their day in court. And they agreed to release the funds. And so Jellers filed the initial paperwork for court appearance. And, you know, with this broadened scope of looking at what happened to all these, this loss of land. And within days of him filing, he was targeted in a police sting at his office in Eastport. And it was quite scandalous at the time. And he was found to be in possession of illegal substances. And, you know, they searched his home without him even being present. And there was a lot of skullduggery around that whole situation. And the negotiators of the Settlement Act that I had conversations with, the Penobscot folks, really firmly believed that that was a setup, that that was something, you know, to get back at him for even daring take on this case. And so it was really, you know, intimidating at the time to think about what could happen to somebody who took this on. And he ended up being debarred and was not able to represent the tribe after all. And it was after that happened is when the tribes were able to get Tom Tureen, who became the lawyer associated with the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement. And at the time, he was just an intern law student. And when he said that he would take on this case after Don Jellers was unable to, he had no experience whatsoever. And so it's just wild to think about how this case was grew into such an enormous case. It was really a big deal, and that we were being represented by somebody that this was their first case.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, you know, how his values and worldview also influence the process too. I mean, it's mm-hmm. bound to with everybody's in that mix. I was looking at the picture of the signing when President Carter was signing the act and the folks that are standing there, and I've been doing some reading, and Cecil Andrus was Secretary of the Interior at the time, and mm-hmm. talk about serendipity when in 2008, when the state and tribes, we got together to talk about a Truth and Reconciliation Commission process here in Maine around child welfare. We were fortunate to have Jill Williams from the Andrus Family Foundation. She was their program officer, and they actually, that family foundation provided the initial funding for us to start the process. And Jill happened to be the executive director for the Greensboro Truth Commission, which was the first official truth commission in the United States. So those connections are so, I love seeing those connections.
That is, it sounds rather serendipitous, especially to think about how now we are going to be taking a more thorough look at the Maine Indian land claims. And that will be the focus of our next truth-telling tribal-state relations, with a particular focus on the Maine Indian land claims. So that does feel very serendipitous in the truth-telling process. Yeah. So, you know, it's an ongoing battle. You know, it really is. And there's a yeah. lot of information out there that is helpful in understanding it. And we look forward to being able to start providing some resources that people can learn more about this. Yeah, in my opinion, it feels as though this is where we need to go, that we can't continue, you know, just participating in the state government process and expecting changes to happen when the changes, you know, that need to be made is on a more personal level, a level of compassion and understanding.
Yeah,
to begin
I
with.
Yes, I was moved by... I zoomed in on the last hearing when that committee got together, and I was moved by the testimony from several of the members, but I remember in particular Rachel Talbot Ross and Tom Hartnett, yeah. and that level of compassion and moving from the head to the heart. They showed that in their statement. you think about all the people. I mean, that was only 40 years ago. 40, 50 years yeah. ago, and everybody has a story, right? I was 12. I have a story. I remember all of the turmoil and the just the energy. It was quite a time, and being excited, yeah. you know, at the thought of all this money, right? Buying things, having a new bike, and you know, things like I was 12. And being upset when, you know, my mom said, we're not taking it, because she was upset and she wasn't in favor of land being negotiable. So they were all different kinds of things going on. And, you know, and then in the same token, there was probably in 1980, some 12-year-old girl somewhere in Maine that was probably afraid of Indians because that we were going to take her family's property, right? And not understanding. So there's a lot of truth and healing and change that needs to happen yet.
That's right. And that was one of the things that I appreciated learning. Like I said, the Maine Indian Land Claims has been sort of a passion and a focus of mine for a very long time. And I've done a lot of presentations to teachers and educators, students, you name it. And I was so appreciative of the one time when somebody said, you know, this is a really scary time for us too, because I was talking about how there was so much racism at the time, remember? And mm-hmm. so many young people had these stories of, you know, being beat up in school or shot at, you know, with BB guns and, you know, just a lot of hatred. And at the time, there was like this resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, you know, just upriver and West Enfield. And, you know, there was a lot going on, and it was really a scary time. And there's this one letter to the editor that really strikes me, and I'll read it if we have time.
It's really, we have a few minutes left.
Okay. So this letter to the editor, and that's another point about this land claims history, is how the media played into that, right?
Yes.
So really staring things up and selling those newspapers. But what started happening is that citizens, you know, Maine citizens started to warn each other about the land claims through newspaper editorials and opinion pieces. And so this one particular one was from 1977, and it's entitled Serious Business. And it reads, "To the editor, the lead article in your January 17th edition regarding the possible eviction of 350,000 Maine residents is very serious business. We residents of northern and eastern Maine had better snap out of our slumber and consider what counteraction should be taken. I have watched the Maine Indians all my life as they received more and more goodies from the public coffer. The taxpayer builds them houses, recreation centers, sewage treatment facilities, and businesses. The taxpayer furnishes them all the necessities and many of the luxuries of life, including free legal services with which to gather in more goodies. All of this because of some strange guilt-ridden theory that we owe something to these people." And, you know, this really strikes me because, you know, just the level of the lack of understanding in this little piece about, you know, the taxpayer builds some houses. The taxpayer, there's like, do they not think that we're taxpayers too? Right.
And you know how many times I have heard that you get everything for free? And it's just, it just hit me those were the origins of that, or one of them. Wow.
Well, I think that one of the origins of that belief comes from the fact that the state ended up, you know, holding tribal monies in their coffers. Mm-hmm. And like I said, how Don Jellis had to go and ask for this money, right? So the state was holding money in the tribal coffers. Mm-hmm. And there's this one report. It's known as the Proctor Report. It's the report on Maine Indians by Ralph Proctor, and it was prepared at the request of a legislative research committee in 1942. And this Proctor Report documents the taking of these, you know, large swaths of tribal lands that were supposed to have been held in perpetuity, right? Meaning forever and never to be changed. But in this Proctor report, it says, and this is a quote from the report, "The Indians' awards of the state, so treated and recognized, in other words, the state is the guardian of the Indian tribes within its limits. If this is the case, then it's the duty of the state to take care of, manage, and control the property of these tribes in a prudent and economic manner and for their benefit. To this end, it would be the state's duty, if it found some of their property being depreciated in value or wasting away, to sell the same and invest the proceeds in such way and manner that the Indian should derive benefit from." And so the right to control our own affairs was denied by the state government. And then this decision to secure and control tribal money was recorded in this resolve, and the report stated that following the sale of all their pine timber under the direction of the Indian agent, it says, quote, "All monies received for the sale shall be vested in some fund or stocks, and the income thereof shall be secured and appropriated for the benefit of said Indians in such manner and for such purposes as the governor and council shall direct, but no part thereof shall be paid to the Indians in money, provisions, or clothing." So they sell the lands that are being held by treaty in perpetuity. They sell it out from under the tribes, and then they keep the money. Right. And so then
and then gaslight everybody into thinking that we get everything for free and that they pay
right,
for it.
Right, because we had to keep going to them to ask for our money.
Oh. Well, thank you, listeners. Thank you, Maria, for being our guest today. Thank you for joining us on Dawnland Signals. Thank you to our volunteer technician, Jeffrey Hotchkiss, for his assistance and support. Be sure to join us next month and every third Thursday of the month for Dawnland Signals and more critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Stay tuned here on WERU for the upcoming program, Radioactive, with Meredith DeFrancesco. Take care.